The Athletic Support is brought to you by GameTime, your new go-to app for the best deals on last-minute tickets. Did you know Canadians' ticket prices tend to drop right before the game starts? GameTime tracks prices in real time from thousands of trusted sellers, then shows you all the best last-minute deals with prices up to 60% off. More than 12 million fans have downloaded the GameTime app and discovered the fastest, easiest way to get into the game. The great thing about the GameTime app is just how simple it is. It's quick, easy to navigate. You get in, get your tickets, and you're out. And while you're in there, you can even see exactly what it's going to look like from your seat, because there's a panoramic seat view from every ticket that you're thinking about buying. So you're basically going to know exactly what you're looking at before you even get into the building. So head to the App Store or the Play Store now to download Game Time and score awesome deals on last minute tickets.
Friday, November 8th. Welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens by The Athletic. I am Marc-Antoine Gonin alongside Arpin Basu. Hello, Arpin.
Hey, I'm glad you got here from Philadelphia. I thought it was going to be a little dicey, but you're here.
I'm happy to see you. I'm here, and I showed up in Philadelphia. Not the whole team did, though.
No, not a great performance, and really... you know, the old, like, emotional letdown cliche after that game against Boston, and I don't know if that had something to do with it. Philly might also have just played a really good game, which I thought they did.
Yeah.
Really took it to the Canadiens in many of the same ways the Canadiens attempt to take it to teams. I think you could tell right from the get-go, really, that the Dino line didn't have it. You know, they didn't have those dominant early shifts in the offensive zone. They were struggling to control the puck and have it. But the good sign for me is that the Canes had a game like that, and then Carey Price bailed them out and got them a point that
exactly.
They didn't deserve.
Yeah.
And we haven't seen that from Carey Price. And coming off what looked like a shell of Carey Price against Boston, letting in two, if not three, questionable goals in that game, you know, to see him do that and really... You know, an old school Carey Price performance when he regularly was bombarded with shots and was regularly territorially dominated, and to see him perform like that, you know, it was almost like it was throwback Thursday night in Philadelphia in that sense. But it's an encouraging sign, because in my eyes, you know, around this time last year is when Carey Price went into his little reset there and took a break, and so maybe this year he. Maybe that performance is indicative of him not needing that reset this year. Maybe he's figured something out. I don't know. I don't want to make too much out of one performance, but it is at least a sign that he did figure something out that night.
Yeah. Well, the point that I was making in my article after the game against the Flyers was that the best thing that he can do for the Canadiens is by having that sort of that level of performance. It's that he buys the team time so that they can fix other issues that they've got. So if he's only okay, nothing spectacular, but just, you know, good goalie, it won't be enough to offset the defensive misuse that we've seen, or the occasional 5-on-5 play that collapses like it did against Philly. But when he stands on his head and is able to steal one or two points, well, then the team's able to buy some time and work on those things, and it enables them to you know, to continue in their calendar, figure things out, and remain in the hunt. So I'm totally with you there that if he can, I would not expect him necessarily to have that sort of performance every night.
But I would expect the Canadiens to have that kind of performance every night. They generally haven't this season. So
yeah, but they're both. I mean, Price has got to be better than he was in the first month of the season, and the Canadiens probably won't be as bad as they were against Philly. So all things being equal, I think that it's just a matter of finding a good balance. You know, if they can find a stretch where Price is at his best and the team, not everybody or not everything will click at the same time, because it never does. But if most of the team clicks at the same time, well, then you could get on the win streak that could make a huge difference in the standings, you know. And we see it right now with the New York Islanders with their crazy run that surely will help them down the road in the playoff
race. And that's why I thought that performance from Price was so timely, because of this stretch of the schedule that the Canadians are going into, where they're playing teams that are out of the playoffs. I mean, I think Philly was the first out of a run of, I think it's 9 of 11 games. The only two teams who were in a playoff position as of Wednesday were Boston and Washington, that they played the rest of the month of November. And so they play 8 of their 11 games at home. They have all sorts of factors. They, you know, they only have two back-to-backs on both their back-to-backs. Their opponent is also playing on a back-to-back. So there are all sorts of factors this month that make it so that the Canadians need to take full advantage of this month. And mm-hmm. if Price being off his game could have completely derailed that. Like, the Canadians could hit this stretch firing on all cylinders and have a wonky Carey Price behind them, and it would all be for naught. You know, they would continue win one, lose one the way they kind of did, you know, early on. If Price has found his game, and so that would by extension say mitigate the problems on the penalty kill a little bit, and the Canadians continue their play at 5-on-5, which has been pretty strong all season, they should be able to go on a decent run here, and they almost have to, because if they don't, then the December, January, February are all very difficult, and then March, April is just a murderer's row of a schedule. So,
Yeah. You
know, it's really early to be talking about the playoffs, but, you know, having a Carey Price that looked like he did in Philadelphia, if he can continue that this month, they can bank some points, create a bit of a cushion, get into maybe even one of the, you know, maybe burrow themselves into one of those top three spots in the division, if possibly, if the Maple Leafs keep sort of floundering the way they have. And then later on in the schedule, you have some wiggle room, and that wiggle room needs to be created now.
Right. I don't think they'll ever get to the point where they got wiggle room, but they have to play in order to at least stay within striking distance and be not on the outside looking in, but be one of the teams that's ahead, you know. But they will. I don't think they'll ever be good enough to create themselves a cushion, because the pack is so, it's just so tight.
Right, but all it takes is a streak, like a 5-game winning streak, builds you a cushion, because that pack is so tight, and because the majority of the teams in that pack are winning one, losing one, winning two, mm-hmm. losing one, losing two, winning one. I mean, that's so, if you get a decent streak in here, then when it's your turn to go into the sort of rough patches and whatever, and it's those teams' turns. So, yeah, by the end, I don't think they're going to have any wiggle room. But at some point in the schedule, I feel they have to create that wiggle room, because they're not, I can't see, it would be a monumental task for them to go into March and they're right on the bubble of the playoffs to finish in a playoff spot. Because those last 15 games are just murderous. Like, I mean, it's 10 to 15 on the road, a California trip thrown in there.
Which is never good news.
Which is never good news. You got Tampa. You got, I don't know if Buffalo Nashville. Keeps playing. Nashville twice. Buffalo, if they keep playing the way they have there twice. Florida's in there twice. So who knows? They'll probably be competing with them for a playoff spot. I mean, there's all sorts of implications at the end of the season. That it's parity has made it so that you have to look at that stuff now in November.
Yeah,
I would never consider looking at what March is in November, and I would never consider writing a story saying they have to do this in November to make the playoffs in April. Never before, but now, when every point is calculated and you have to kind of look at probabilities, they kind of have to do that. And so Price playing the way he did on Thursday, if he can keep that up for a few more weeks here, maybe they can build a little bit of a, maybe cushion's the wrong word, but they need to bank points.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And probably the approach to who their real rivals are will be important in the way that they identify the we've got a colleague in Washington, Ben Rabbi, mm-hmm. who was exchanging with you on Twitter, and he said, well, they're not called must wins, but they're called auto wins.
Auto wins, yeah.
And
you ought to win that game.
Right. And these auto win games, they're not necessarily against Atlantic teams. So, because I consider that the game yesterday against Philly was definitely a 4-point game.
Yeah.
Because it's a direct rival. It's a team of pretty much same strength as the Canadiens, and they're going to fight each other for a playoff spot. So it's, to a certain extent, it's more important to win against Philly than it is to bank up points against against Ottawa.
Yeah.
You know, so it's those games, and I'm curious to see how the Canadiens are going to approach those games and how they're going to correctly identify who's the bigger opponent, mainly in the way that they manage their goaltender. We see two things traditionally in hockey, that the number one goaltender will face the tougher team and he's going to play at home. But you were mentioning earlier the fact that in the next few weeks, the Canadiens are going to have two back-to-backs. Those yes. back-to-backs, the first game is an away game against a superior opponent to the day after, the night after, at the Bell Centre.
Right.
So, and traditionally you say, well, the Canadiens, they tend to keep Carey Price for the Bell Centre. But is the primary motive here is to please the fans? They paid their tickets, so they ought to see the number one goaltender. Or you're going to manage in a way that we're going to play Carey Price in Washington because it's more important, and let's let Kincaid play the Devils, his former team, at the Bell Centre. Same logic the week after. Columbus is a tougher opponent than Ottawa. They're on the road, but these are the points that you need the most.
There's also the logic of, like, the logic Mike Babcock's been using, which I think it actually has some merit, and which Claude Julien used actually on the Arizona trip, which is that you play your number one in the first game because that's the best chance you have of winning. The game you have the most chance of winning is the first game, no matter the opponent. You're fresh. So double down on the freshness, double down on your chances of winning that game, put your number one in to lock those 2 points down, and then roll the dice with your backup in the second game, because even with your number one, chances are your team's not going to have legs. Chances are it's going to be a tougher, not in this case, because both New Jersey and Ottawa will also be on back-to-backs, but generally speaking, you know, in that case, Vegas, who had rested for, what, 2-3 days before the game, I think it would be only rational for Claude to say, okay, listen, my best chances of getting 4 points out of this trip are in Arizona and Dallas.
Right.
And so why don't I play Price in those two games and lock those 4 points down, and whatever happens in Vegas is gravy. And as it turns out, they got the 2 points in Vegas and did not get them in Dallas. But I kind of see that, you know, tired against rested teams is going to become a way bigger thing. It's already a bigger thing than it ever has been this season. But as the season goes on, I think we're going to see that play into a lot more decision-making than we have in the past.
Vegas was actually coming back from a trip. But it just got, to come back to your point from earlier with Carey Price.
Arizona was coming back from a trip.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I'm going to mix it up. But yes, you're right. It was Arizona, not Vegas. But Carey Price, if he's in such a form that he can bail out his team, you could argue that the team in itself, being fresh and ready to go, has his better chance of winning on the first night. But if you keep your number one goalie for the second night, and you know who's rested and who's able to steal games, well, then why do you really have to roll the dice on one of the two games if you can just find different ways to put the odds in your favor on both of those games, you know?
But I mean, it's like in that case, okay, well, let's just take that Arizona trip as an example. I think he did that. You could anticipate that the Canadiens would have no legs in Dallas playing their third game in 4 nights in three different cities.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I think he kind of did that. So like but at the same time, prior to Thursday, what reasonable assurance could Claude Julien have that his goalie could steal anything?
Oh, and he doesn't have that insurance
even now.
Right. It's one game. It's one game.
It's one game. It was a hell of a game, and it was a vintage performance. And hopefully for his sake and the Canadian's sake, he can continue doing that.
Right.
But I wouldn't bank on it. Like, I would still be managing my goaltenders based on an expectation of very good play from Carey Price. Mm-hmm. Like, not world-beating, go into a building and steal a point play. I would just kind of expect, okay, Carey Price will not cost us this game and could very well win us this game. We'll be, I expect him to be very good. Not
costing
good.
Us a game is a low bar for a $10.5 million hog.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not talking about his salary. I don't want to talk about his salary. Why do you bring up his salary? He's just a goalie. That's all he is. He's your goalie. And, you know, Claude doesn't think about his salary. He doesn't, when he's making decisions about Carey Price, well, we pay him $10.5 million. He doesn't pay him anything. So, but the bar, yeah, that is a low bar. But let's be honest, over the first month of the season, that's kind of the bar he created, because there were games where he was on the verge of costing them games. The Boston game, had they lost, you could easily say Carey Price cost them that game.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They didn't lose, so you don't say that. And there have been at least two or three other games this season where it was kind of the same thing. So that's why I think it's that performance in Philly was so significant.
Talking about erectile dysfunction isn't easy. Usually we just brush it off or blame ourselves, saying things like, I lost my mojo. Or we avoid it altogether with excuses like, I had a long day at work, or sorry honey, I'm just not feeling it. But with Roman, it is easy to talk about it, with a real doctor who can prescribe real medication. It's simple, safe, and totally discreet. With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for ED, all from the comfort and privacy of your home. The doctor will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, Roman will ship it to you with free two-day shipping. The whole process is straightforward, simple, and discreet. Getting started is simple. Just go to GetRoman.com/support and complete an online visit. Erectile dysfunction used to be tough to tackle, but now there's Roman. Complete an online visit today to connect with a doctor and take care of it.
We have, dealt with a bunch of mailbags. Our subscribers at The Athletic have sent you a lot of questions for a mailbag that you wrote and published last week on The Athletic. But there were some questions that were not addressed. And what we've decided to do today is to take those questions and basically have sort of a mailbag episode of The Athletic support. So probably, since we're discussing a season outlook for what are things to come and Carey Price and whatnot, let's start maybe with the one that's probably more bigger picture type of question that you received.
Yeah, well, we do have we had a few bigger picture questions, but there's the one that I think is actually really interesting. So I'm going to read this. This comes from Anthony M. I kind of wish we had like last names on the app.
Yeah, I know.
Sorry, Anthony. I don't know your last name, but Anthony writes, it is hard as a Habs fan to not have an eye on the future given the great prospect pool Marc Bergevin has built. That being said, it would not be hard to envision more than 3 or 4 prospects graduating to the NHL next year. I think he means it would be hard to envision more than 3 to 4 prospects graduating to the NHL next year. I would imagine Caulfield and Poehling are very close. Obviously, Poehling played on Thursday and Tuesday. We must also consider European prospects Ulinen and Romanov, who will make decisions tougher on manager. That being said, it is unrealistic to have them all here at once. This is true. But it is a numbers game, and there is a big summer coming 2 summers from now in 2021. Noteworthy, our highest paid player wants us to be in win now mode, and given the assets we have, there's certainly potential to make something happen. If you were standing in Bergevin's shoes, what would be your objective for the team? Short-term adjustments to lead to success or a longer-term patience approach? This is the crux of Marc Bergevin's problem.
Oh, yeah.
This question.
Absolutely.
This
absolutely.
Really cuts to the core of it.
Yeah.
So I will begin with my impressions on that is that, I think of a prospect like Alan McShane, who seems to be a a prospect with some potential to perhaps make the NHL, but is performing well. And were he in another team's prospect pool that was not quite as deep as Montreal's is right now, I feel like that team would be more excited about Alec McShane than the fans of the Canadiens are, just because there's only so much prospect attention to go around. And there are other more exciting, more promising prospects, but
yes, there's a bunch. There's a dozen of
He's
them.
Down the list. So the question becomes, do these prospects, you know, we were talking about Cam Hillis earlier, who's playing well in Guelph. There's all these prospects that are kind of like...
We're talking about Cam Hillis off the air. You didn't miss anything, guys.
Yes, off the air, I meant, yes. So now we're just rehashing the conversation. So Cam Hillis is playing really well in Guelph right now after like just this injury-plagued nightmare season last year. There's a bunch of prospects like these in the Canadian system that no one really seems to care about or is excited right. about. Do these prospects have enough value on the market? And even going up the ladder, does an Ulanen or even a Romanov or some of their better prospects up front?
Jordan Harris on defense.
Jordan Harris. There's guys around that maybe Mark Bergevin could start gauging interest in around the league. Do you think there would be interest in guys like the guys we just mentioned?
Well, for I think a guy like Ulanen who must have been considered as a first-round type of prospect by certain teams.
He definitely was.
Yeah.
Yes.
He could draw some interest. I don't think that he's done anything in Finland to discourage or displease the teams that I had an eye on this guy. And you don't want to wait too long until the prospect has faded in a way that the original picture, the original image that a team had on the prospects sort of fades. You know, you want to keep that alive and well. That being said, if you make a move on still a young prospect, there's always that gamble that he might be the one blossoming, and you might say down the road, 4 or 5 years down the road, well, that this was not the prospect that we should have traded. But I think that if you want to, if the path is to say, well, we're going to trade one of our prospects, you go and in order to go short term with our plan, well, you got to give up a significant prospect. I don't think that neither McShane or Cam Hillis would do the trick. You get into Ulonen category, Romanov category, or even Jordan Harris, then it's another story.
Josh Brook.
Yeah. Absolutely. So to me, there are really five guys, and I don't mean the hamburgers, but there are five guys that I think the Canadians should stick to, and those are Kotkaniemi, Poehling, Caulfield, Suzuki, and Primo.
Yeah.
Outside of those five, I think that the Canadians should really assess what they have, who they have, what could be the interest.
Assess the market for them, yeah.
Is there
a market for them?
Is there? Yeah, absolutely. And assess the market, and also, who at this point do we still believe is going to pan out? When Marc-Bergevin traded Kolberg, you know, after making him a second-round pick in the Thomas Vanek trade, you know, he told us in our interview at the beginning of the season, he said, oh, Kolberg, well, he could have panned out, you know, and we were taking a risk. But I got a feeling that by then, they already had a feeling that they could part with this guy and there was a legitimate chance that he would not become what they were hoping he would become when they first drafted him.
Sure. And yeah, you're right in the sense that you do need to take advantage of administrations and other teams, front offices and other teams still having regret over not being able to draft a certain guy or not doing enough to get a certain guy in the draft. You know, I think Vegas probably did that to a certain extent with Suzuki. I don't know.
Yeah.
Probably, I would think. The Canadiens, you know, I think, had him relatively high on their list that year. So yeah, but all this to say, like, philosophically speaking, I think that, you know, Anthony's question is legitimate, that it's great having all these guys, and I even include all the Hillises and McShanes and all these other these sort of the B or C list kind of prospects. It's great having them, but they're not all going to play in the NHL. And when are they at their peak value? And so, I don't know, let's say, I think McShane's still eligible for the World Juniors. Let's say he makes the World Junior team, plays in the World Juniors, has a good tournament. All of a sudden, he ups his value.
Right.
Similar to the other guy. I mean, you have to pick moments. You know, I don't know, OHL playoffs come and Cam Hill lights the world on fire. Now he's got value. So you do have to make a determination on these guys as to when is their peak value and what is the likelihood they're going to play in our lineup in the next X number of months, let's say, or years.
Yeah.
And make sort of a risk-reward assessment there. But I think the Canadians are reaching a point where they have so many prospects that they can afford to try and package two or three and turn them into an immediate asset that could help them right away because, let's be honest, the priority for this team has changed over the last 12 months in a big way. Like last year, they hoped to fight to be in a playoff spot, which is exactly what they did. And this year, they hope to be in the playoffs. There's a nuance there, you know. So it's he still thinks Bergevin still thinks they're going to fight for a playoff spot. But I think the expectation is now to be in the playoffs and not simply fight for a spot.
Yeah, you have to show progress.
Yeah, you know? You have to take the next step, which That's is right. go into the playoffs. And in order to do that, I think Bergevin, I think is probably ready to be a bit more aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
Because remember at the trade deadline last year when he refused to trade any asset of any value whatsoever, still wound up getting two really useful players in Jordan Wheel and Nate Thompson for practically nothing, but was very reluctant to use picks, prospects, or anything to get anything that was available on the market when he had a team that was doing exactly what he asked them to do and needed, might have appreciated a little push to get in. And imagine, you know, the Canadiens players watching Columbus sweep Tampa Bay and thinking, oh, that could have been us. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, whether that's realistic or not is irrelevant. The players watching that could have been like, man, if we just got this little extra oomph at the end of February, maybe that could have been us. So I think Bergevin this year is gonna act on that. He'd be more willing to act on that. Let me rephrase that. I think he'll be willing to act on that this year, whereas last year, I don't think he had much of a willingness. Like, he had to be blown out of the water with a bargain last year in order to trade something, whereas this year, I think he'd be open to it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, I mentioned the five prospects that I thought I would hold on to, and at the same time, it's further to the question that was being asked. I mean, it's going to be hard for the Canadians to have a lineup, let's say, as soon as next year, where you would have Kotkaniemi, Caulfield, Suzuki, Poehling, all four of them in the lineup.
Yeah.
You know, if Caulfield proves to be deserving of a spot right from the get-go, because he...
Hell, he might have a spot in April.
Well, there you go. So,
or March, but, even.
So, it becomes a very... You know, the more years advance, it's a younger team. It's ironic because you got Price and Weber that are getting older and older, and at the same time, up front, they would get younger and younger because of that crop of prospects that's arriving. So it's...
And I would argue that having young forwards is a good thing, and having more experienced defensemen is a good thing, and having an experienced goaltender is a good thing. I mean, in theory, and it's... If there's one position where I'd be comfortable having less experience as forward.
Yeah,
of the three.
Yeah, but maybe not center, though.
No, not center. No, you're right. Not ideally, but, I mean, if you have high-end skilled centers that you use a number three overall pick on, or that you traded the top scorer of the decade on your team or the captain of your team to get, I'd be a little bit more comfortable with that. You know, you've already used very valuable assets to acquire these players. Well, put them in.
Right.
You know, you got to put them in. So that question actually segues nicely into another question, which was asked by...
I think it was about
Taylor Hall. What are the chances, if Taylor Hall makes it to UFA, that he winds up in Montreal? I'm going to find out who asked that question just in a second. But the crux of it is that Any chance to see Hall in Montreal next year if he makes 2FA? Benoit C.
Okay.
So, the only chances I see of Taylor Hall signing an unrestricted free agent contract with Montreal is if Montreal acquires him at the trade deadline. We talked to Mark Bergevin about this, this very phenomenon, that if he makes it to UFA and he can pick any team he wants, history has shown that the chances of him picking Montreal are slim to none. The only chance Montreal has is to bring a player in at the deadline, and Bergevin basically admitted this, or not the only chance, but he said their chances greatly increase if you bring a player in at the deadline, allow him to experience a stretch drive in Montreal, hopefully some playoff games in Montreal. And what Bergevin actually said is expose them to how Jeff Molson treats the players, how the organization treats them, all the extra little things that you get as a member of the Canadiens. Let them see that, you know, let them practice in Brossard and use all the facilities. That's your best chance of signing a guy. I mean, Jeff Petrie didn't even make it to July 1st. He signed before, and he probably could have made, I think he could have made more money on the open market. That's just my opinion, but
maybe some people, maybe half a million more.
Maybe half a million more a year. Yeah. I do remember what I was covering the Cup final when he signed. We were in Nashville, and there was a member of the media from Edmonton who was just stunned at the contract. Like, how can you give Jeff Petrie that kind of money? And I was like, I don't know.
I'm sure I know which member of the media you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm not going to throw anyone under the bus. But anyhow, so so all that being said, that experience. Mark Bergevin is acutely aware of the fact that if you are targeting a guy who's going to be UFA and who is on the rental market, who has not decided not to re-sign with his team, which is none of which might be true in Taylor Hall's case, but if it is, and Montreal has interest, their best chance of signing him on July 1st is to trade for him at the end of February.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm with you on that. But it's the risky thing is that the Canadiens are not in a position, they're not good enough to acquire a guy as a rental if they're not going to, if they're not confident in their chances of signing the player, especially in Taylor Hall's case, who might very well be the more sought after rental at the trade deadline if he hasn't signed with the Devils. So there's going to be a bidding war for his services. So you're gonna give up assets at the trade deadline to acquire him. Mm-hmm. You better have a good feeling that you're going to be able to sign him right from the get-go. I don't know how much back-channeling can be done to have a better understanding of what the player looks for and what realistically could be.
The Canadiens are currently in negotiations with the same agent.
Yeah.
For Victor Mete.
Well, there you go.
So I don't know. You're not technically allowed to talk about other teams' players, no. But
the rules of tampering are murky. You know, it's like
they're more like suggestions. Yeah,
that's it.
They're not quite rules.
So to me, that's the first stumbling block is if you are ready, if you acquire Taylor Hall and you're willing to give up assets, to give up probably a couple of those prospects that we were discussing earlier and more. You got to feel that you have a good chance at signing him. Second of all, Taylor Hall is 28 years old, or soon going to be. I think he already is. He's an injury-prone player.
Yep.
And he's going to want to...
Never really played in the playoffs.
No.
Not a whole lot.
No. And he's going to want
you could win a draft lottery or two.
He's going to want a long-term contract. He's going to want an expensive contract. So I see. Let's say he says he wants 8 years out of the team that owns his rights. In this case, the Canadiens for $9 million a year.
Yeah.
All right. Well, in that case. The Canadiens, I don't see the Canadiens under the situation and under, we've talked numerous times about the cap, how would you?
Cap-mageddon.
The
summer of 2021.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't see the Canadiens being able to afford a salary of that sort after 2021, unless a guy like Max Domi, for example, is not in the books, because Max Domi, as everybody knows, is an RFA at the end of the year. They'll have to sign him to a new contract, but I don't see the Canadiens adding all without subtracting another piece, and to me the most evident piece would be Domi. So it becomes a question of would you rather have all for 8 years at $9 million, or you would have Domi, as you suggested in the mailbag on The Athletic to have, let's say, you suspected that Domi might want a shorter term contract in order to test free agency later on. So a 3-year contract at 6.5, for example.
Yeah.
So it's not, and it's bare mentioned that Domi's 3 years younger, doesn't have like the injury record that all has. And he brings a sort of a jam that the Canadians don't have in spades exactly, you know? So it's,
right.
It's,
I think there would be ways to do it while keeping Domi though. Yeah. There would be other players.
Something, that you could, yeah, okay, but something would have to give.
Would have to give. You know, Petrie's contract is up in 2021. He'll be 33 at that point, I want to say.
Yeah, but half of the city's already asking Marc Bergevin to trade Shea Weber because they already have Jeff Petrie, who's the new number one defenseman. And they have an issue on defense. I don't see them really helping their case by letting go of their number one defenseman.
Well, we're talking 2 years from now.
Yeah.
So
I don't see any young defenseman taking summer, but Weber next or summer. Petrie's place in the next 2 years.
Right, but you gotta also try to project, like, how good will Jeff Petrie be in 2021?
Mm-hmm.
A guy who relies on his feet a lot.
Yeah.
Like, his legs need to be worked. Like, Shea Weber can survive if he slows down a little. If he loses a step, probably still be a relatively useful player, you know, not one worthy of his, not one that makes as much money as he does,
yeah. But
you could still use him in your lineup. If Jeff Petrie loses a step or two, that's not a very effective player all of a sudden. Like, yeah, his game is transition, and his game is moving the puck with his feet and with his head, and he has a lot of attributes, but if he gets slower,
yeah.
It's a big aspect of his game.
I agree, but 2 years down the road, there will be some cap casualties and guys that will not be re-signed just in order to sign guys like Gallagher to a new deal or Kotkaniemi for that matter. So,
or Dano or Poehling. I mean, it's not, if there is going to be cap casualties. So look at the prime guys who are up for in 2021. Dano, is he the casualty? Gallagher, mm-hmm. Is he the casualty? An argument can be made for each of these guys: Dano, right. Gallagher, Petrie.
I think it's fair to say that Tatar would be the one let go. That's pretty.
I take that. I didn't even list him because I think
it's a given.
It's a given almost at this point. So yeah. One of those three guys, you could make a valid argument for each of them. Dano, they have Kotkaniemi, they have Poehling, they have Suzuki. They could have three centers. Maybe he's not necessary at that point, even though you would love to keep him. Gallagher, a lot of tread on those tires. It has gone through a lot of abuse. He's going to want to be paid commensurate to how great he is, because he is great and he probably will be great until that point. Do you give him
a thank you contract?
A thank you contract for many, many years into his mid to late 30s. And then Petrie for all the reasons I just listed. So, you know, it's hard to see any one of those three guys being allowed to walk,
mm-hmm.
just for nothing. So either you trade them or you sign them. And it's coming to a head as of July. All three guys, including Tatar, all four of those guys can start to negotiate with the Canadiens on a contract extension if they so choose. But so all this to say,
yeah, about to Taylor go. Rall. Tell me what you think about Taylor Rall.
To answer the question is that I think they could conceivably sign Taylor Hall, do some other things, and fill in those gaps with like all the extra money they're spending on guys like, you know, Nick Cousins, Kulak, Riley. Like, there's a lot of like extra millions that they sprinkled around in the line. Even Thompson. Like, you know, there's little luxury items. Armia, Lehkonen. Like, there's guys on the team that if you can shed money by getting rid of these little perks that you've given mm-hmm. out, if you want to bring in a guy like Taylor Hall, and that I think you could find some money that way, enough money that way to make it work without having to shed a Max Domi.
Right, but that might involve giving away guys like Byron, like and then because you're going to be forced to squeeze some money out and find takers, and that means.
But that's the beauty of their drafting.
Yeah,
that's why they've draft. That's why you draft well, because if you do have to trade away a Byron or a Lehkonen for basically nothing to make money, to make room. Under the cap, you should have a prospect that could walk right into that spot and fill it on an entry-level deal. So, I don't know. I feel that this is another area where having the prospects that they have allows them to consider things that they might not have been able to consider had they not had a good draft or two good drafts in a row.
Right.
The way they have.
So, but I think that... I think the Canadians might consider this this way of thinking if depending on the way the season goes, and if by trade deadline they seem that they're in a position for a playoff spot, and by adding a guy like Taylor Hall, they could do a push in the playoffs. That's probably like the ideal circumstances by which they consider to acquire a guy like that. But I just don't see them, even with adding all, becoming a cup contender this year, you know. So,
well, I don't know. I honestly don't know. If you get in the play, it's in this age of parity and everything. The Bergevin's old line that I cringed every time he said it in the past. Where you get in the playoffs and then you never know.
Yeah,
you really do never know now. I don't know. Let's say Montreal squeezes into the third spot in the division and they face Boston in the first round. Is it guaranteed they'll lose to Boston? They'll probably lose to Boston, but I could see a scenario under which they would beat Boston in a 7-game series. It could happen.
Well, they know how to beat Boston
exactly
better than anybody else.
Could they beat Toronto in a 7-game series? Maybe.
Yeah.
It's not impossible. They could beat Tampa in a 7-game series. Columbus did it last year. Mm-hmm. They swept them, you know? So I feel like... this is what I found so weird about Bergevin's behavior at the deadline, and I commended it. I found it commendable because he's a guy who's always been, you get in the playoffs and you never know. Well, man, if he had acted on that impulse last year, he would have started spending assets to get in at all costs, because all of a sudden they were within striking distance and he was able to do something and he resisted that temptation. And I think that was the right move. This year, I think the context has changed somewhat. There are expectations from ownership, from fans, from everyone.
There might be more pressure on him, too.
That's what I think. And so I think he'd be more compelled to make a bigger move and sort of spend some futures this year, as we had just finished for the previous question. So if Taylor Hall is available and the Canadians have this wealth of draft picks and prospects that are of interest to other teams... and players, I don't know. I think he might go for it.
Yeah. Well, you would probably have the assets. You would probably have the assets to.
And he'd probably have. I'd probably have be one of the best placed teams in terms of assets to get there, including cap space.
Right. So we've got another question on Cole Julien, right?
First we're gonna get to this one. I thought we'd finish with the Julien one, but we have two questions from George K. Again.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, George. K. And Maxime V. Sorry, Maxime. Both on Ben Chiarot. George asked, with some games under his belt, how do you feel about the Chiarot signing? Whereas Maxime was a little bit more blunt. Can you please double check if there's a 30-day money-back guarantee provision on the Ben Chiarot contract? If there is, let Marc Bergevin know ASAP. To be fair, both of these questions were asked on October 29th. We are now November 8th, so it's gone. It's
how
been
quickly things change.
How
right?
quickly do things do change? Because I think on October 29th, Maxim's snarky question had some merit to it, and did not seem all that snarky at the time. Actually, seemed kind of realistic. I think since then. You know, the shine on Ben Chiarot has obviously grown. He's scored a couple of goals. He, you know, helped shut down the Patrice Bergeron powerhouse against Boston. Claude Julien has been calling it rather obvious. Every time he's been asked, have you noticed that?
Yeah.
Over the last few days, he says, I feel it's rather obvious that he's playing much better now.
Yeah. Well, the rather obvious, it's something that he started saying last year.
Yeah.
To me, it's plainly obvious that
right.
even on things that are not that obvious necessarily.
It's like it's sort of a backhanded shot at the questioner. Like, why are you asking me this question? This is obvious.
That's it.
Anyhow, that's a hockey reporter aside there. But so Ben Chiarot. So I just feel, you know, he is kind of what I thought he would be. I think a lot of people is like, why are you giving him the contract? I think you could still think that. I just think that he is a guy who provides comfort to coaches. You heard Paul Maurice talk about him. Kevin Cheveldayoff talk about him. Mark Bergevin talk about how they've been following him since he was in the AHL. And now Claude Julien just likes the fact that now he's getting used to their system, where he's supposed to be, what he's supposed to do. It provides a physical element, and it's just making better decisions now. And so after...
Well, because he adapted to the system.
He adapted to the system. He adapted to the conference, to the opposition. There's a lot of difference there. You know, I think Eastern Conference hockey is somewhat, if not significantly, quicker than Western Conference hockey. And it was not as if he's probably playing on one of the lowest paced teams in the league in Winnipeg, which you would think is not the case, but
it is. They are. Yeah. It's on par with LA.
Yeah.
In that department.
LA of last year. LA of this year somehow has become this super, super paced team. But anyhow, that's we'll see them on Saturday.
Their traditional image, I would
say. Yeah. So that takes an adjustment. So I would say right now, and this answer has definitely changed from the time that George and Maxim asked it on October 29th, it's in their defense. But, you know, he's starting to look pretty good right now. He's helping them out. And he's no longer... You know, I thought the ceiling on Ben Chiarot, and it might wind up being this, is Ben Chiarot will just be kind of neutral, whereas he doesn't help you win, but he doesn't make you lose, kind of thing. He's just kind of there, and he just does things and gives you minutes. Right. I always find that the weirdest compliment to say that, oh, he gives us minutes, when they talk about players. Could there be anything less descript about a player than, oh, he goes out and plays minutes, you know?
Yeah, well, there's...
Mark Bergevin said that. He's like, I thought he'd give us 18, 19 minutes. I'm like, oh, that's
good. There's nothing worse than a guy that costs you something, though.
And well, yeah.
Especially in the eyes of a coach, you have a risky player offensively that costs you goals or on defense. I've got a picture of Mike Riley in my head right now. But guys that are risky, that are mistake prone, and that will cost you. I don't feel like Chiarot is a guy that costs you a whole lot, because he's meant to bring some stability. It might not be flashy, but it's not going to tip the scale in either way.
No, so. And he provides an element that the coach and the GM value.
Yeah. And also, let's face it, I think that you and I were both Brett Kulak's apologists last season. He didn't start the season the way that he wanted. He probably has... 3, if not 4 bad games under his belt since the beginning of season. And you can see that Claude Julien has a shorter leash on this guy. And much more so than on Ben Chiarot. So the instinct of saying, well, we wanted to...
Much more so than even on Cale Fleury.
Yeah.
At this point.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
Like it's...
Well, but they don't play the same position.
Well, no. Well,
because Fleury's alternative is Christian Folin.
It's Christian Folin, who you would agree... And Claude has time for Christian Folin, you know? Like, Claude, it's not as if Claude is afraid to play Christian Folin. Like, he sees, obviously, the elements, the puck-moving elements that Cale Fleury has in his game that Folin does not. But it's not as if Claude would be completely and utterly opposed to having Christian Folin in the lineup, only because he hits guys.
Yeah.
And Claude likes having guys who hit guys. So, you know, the fact that Chiarot's been more effective, the fact that Fleury also hits guys helps him in that regard. And the fact that Kulak doesn't help him in that regard. Like, in the sense that he's, I guess Claude sees him as a bit one-dimensional. And if he's struggling with the puck and his number one dimension is playing the puck.
Right.
Then
I don't see him as one-dimensional, though. He's not physical, but when he's on top of his game, he's a guy that helps establishing like clean exits, good transition game, a lot of poise in his game too. You know, there's last year it seems as though he was never rushed into anything. It seems like he had all the time in the world. Whereas now it's not the case.
I agree with you. I was saying that I think Claude sees him as one-dimensional. Yeah. And if that one dimension being an important dimension, like playing with the puck.
Yeah.
All the things you mentioned come with making decisions and playing properly with the puck, exits and entries. And you know, he improved his gap control, which I think is a big thing that Claude wanted from him last year, and he got better at it. But, so if he's struggling with the puck, then... But having Sherratt play the way he has helped has helped stabilize things, even though the defense is still very largely a work in progress. I don't think Mark Bergevin should be checking on the 30-day money-back guarantee.
No. I just want to finish on Sherratt with the experiment with Shea Weber against Boston. I thought it was... A lot of us thought that they would bomb because they're not necessarily the most mobile duo. It turned out very well, and I think that it's an experiment that, that would be interesting to reconsider against teams that are mainly relying on one line to provide their offense. But there's not that many teams in the league that are built that way. Obviously, Boston is. Edmonton is built that way too, but they're crazy fast. First and foremost, because of McDavid, you know, once they return healthy, I think that that the Nathan MacKinnon's line in Colorado is like that, and you've got the LA Kings, who've got one line, but that's only by default because that's all they got. So, but there, so there's very few teams that are built like that, and the way I saw the game against Boston, it can work only if the assignment is so clear that you. You attach to Weber and Sherratt the Deno line, because Claude mentioned it himself after the win against Boston. He said, well, granted, it's probably not our best two defensemen for transition or to move the puck out, but that's really, on normal days, it's really the Deno's line's forte. They're really good at getting the puck out, at, you know, passing quick ups and changing zones. So if you were to put, let's say, the Domi line or any other line than Deno's with that pairing, I'm not sure if the results would be this good.
I'm actually interested. Claude mentioned Washington the other day when he was asked when might we see that again? Like, what teams do you think that would work against? And so, like, basically, it doesn't work against the Leafs because they have two lines that you have to defend. It doesn't work against Tampa because they have two lines that you have to defend. So you mentioned Washington. So they're in Washington on next Friday, a week from today, on the road where they don't control the matchups. So I don't know. Are we going to see that pairing? I'm very curious to see what happens because it's the only team you mentioned. Washington, they're big, they're strong, they're this and that, and it would help to have Sherratt and Weber together. But if you can't control the matchup, then do you still do it?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know, and they're not a one. I know, I understand that he refers to the Ovechkin line, but you know whether Ovechkin plays with Backstrom or with Kuznetsov, that other line, that other sentiment is going to be pivoting a dangerous line anyway.
Yeah, but it's a clear drop off. I mean, I think it's
because of Ovechkin.
Yeah, I understand. It's reasonable. It's like it's more of a drop off than, you know. Well, then Toronto, when they're healthy, like, which Tavares or Matthews, and then, you know, Tampa, you know, Kucherov and Stamkos will often play on different lines or point, or John mixes those top two lines up, but the top two lines have enough talent where they're tough to key in on one line, whereas Washington, I think it is fair to key in on that line, you know.
I wanted yesterday in Philly to ask that question to players, and things didn't turn out that way, but it seems to bring up the fact that pairings like this, you know, it's hard. You don't control the matchups when you're away. Do you think that it's harder to try to survive the matchups with your defensemen or with your forwards?
I think it's harder with your defensemen because they're just harder to change.
Yeah. Especially in the second period.
Especially in the second period, but just in general, it's harder for... You need control of the puck for the defense to change, whereas you don't necessarily need control of the puck to change your forwards. So, you know, I mean, you can win a draw, change your forwards immediately, essentially. You can dump the puck and change your forwards much easier than you can do that with your defense.
Right.
So yeah, I think it is so that's why it's going to be a test when they do get to Washington, which is one of only, I think, three road games they play. Well, actually, last night the game in Philly was one of them, and that's
so there's two more.
There's two more in Washington and in Columbus. So, another reason why they need to bank points, anyhow. And so it's tough to to do that with the defense. So it's, you know, if he throws Sherratt and Weber out there and they counter with, you know, Vrana and Backstrom and whatever, or Kuznetsov or their second line, then for sure the Kuznetsov line is almost guaranteed, or the Ovechkin line is almost guaranteed to get a shift against Mette Petry.
Yeah.
Which is not ideal.
Let's
just call it what it is. Okay, moving on. This is going to be the final question we take in our little mailbag pod today, from Robert P. or Robert P. It's one of those bilingual names. He asked an interesting question, actually. I wanted to answer it, but I just didn't have room in the mailbag, so I'm glad to do it with Marc-Antoine's help here. He says, I'm curious about Julien's demeanor with his players. I noticed that he seems to interact a lot with the assistants behind the bench, sometimes angrily when he's making a point. He seems to leave the interaction with the players to the assistants during the game. Is he the same way outside of the game, addressing the players as a group but rarely talking one-on-one? Would help if I could talk, but rarely talking one-on-one. I am asking because the former coach's behavior was legendary and is the fodder for some great stories by players, and although Julien seems capable of losing it with his players, he doesn't seem to interact with them individually that much. Your observations?
Yeah, well,
I'll let you start.
Okay, well, first of all, Claude does speak one-on-one to his players during the games. It doesn't happen as often as with the assistants, but that's precisely why the assistants are there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's part of their task. At the end of practices in Brassard, you'll see very often that Claude will speak, you know, towards the end of the practice or the morning skate, he'll go to talk to a player, one-on-one conversation. And obviously behind closed doors, there's plenty that can be discussed that we just don't see. So I think that his demeanor with the players is actually very positive. Claude is an intense coach that can lose it behind the bench. He's very impulsive, and once he gets red, when he sees red, obviously that it might his players will see the effect of it. But he seems to keep an overall positive spin on things with his players, and I think that it's an underrated aspect of his coaching. You refer, without naming him, to Michel Therrien, who had a much more aggressive approach, I think, than Claude Julien. So Claude is firm. He can be tough at times, but if you speak to Boston Bruins players, they'll describe him as a player's coach despite everything.
Yeah, I think if you talk to Canadiens players too, I mean, frankly, it's not only after practice, before practice, when they're just skating around, he'll go and skate next to a guy and chat about something. The other day I saw him addressing like the entire Domi line, like Domi, Drouin, and Armia were there after practice, and he was having a pretty in-depth discussion. It was a back and forth. It was a discussion. Drouin was asking questions. Armia was asking questions. He was giving answers. They were pointing, they were discussing things. So, you know, I think Claude does have that, and you're right in the sense that, you know, he will talk to forwards on the bench. You often see him sort of go down in the ear of a forward and mention something to him, but, you know, that's not indicative of anything, really. What we see on television behind the bench during a game is rarely revealing of a relationship between coach and player. It's very revealing of the coach's own demeanor and his ability to handle certain situations. It's revealing of how a coach, to what extent a coach will have his team's back, what he's willing to do, the lengths he's willing to go to. Like John Tortorella is probably at the top of the list in terms of a guy who will fight for his players and will berate refs and will even trash talk the other team. Claude would be pretty high, I think, on that spectrum. He's a guy who does have his players' backs more often than not. There are occasions that I've spoken to players, you know, players who are kind of in Claude's doghouse are not necessarily always given the reasons why they're in the doghouse. That's the one, I think, complaint. But I don't think that's unique to Claude. I think a lot of coaches do that. I'm not saying that's the right thing to do. I think other coaches, if a guy is out of the lineup, they will sit him down and talk to him and explain their decision. I don't think Claude feels the need to do that. I don't think he feels obligated to do that, just like he doesn't feel obligated to explain everything to us. And he'll say it flat out. I don't think I have to stand here and explain everything I do to you guys. I think he does that to his players sometimes too. Like, there are occasions when, now, for instance, when Jordan Wheel was out of the lineup, so I sat next to him one day at practice. I was like, have you been given an indication of why? And he said, no. Is that true? I don't know. But players tend to say, no, they haven't. Mm-hmm. And that's not abnormal. It's not how I would do it, but I'm not a coach.
So it's a little bit old school in the approach. But at the same time, I know that some coaches are concerned that they might be counterproductive in their communication if they overwhelm the player with information on their status and say, well, this is what we expect from you. And they come back too often with either the expectations or securing his place on the team, blah, blah, blah. This is not the sort of conversation that happens often. I think that it's very... The exchanges will be a lot more on a very technical aspect of here's what we expect from you in the game or tonight, and you do this, you do that, and if you don't, well, you'll understand that we're not happy with you. But it's not... You take a guy like Guy Boucher, for example, who was completely in the other way. He was consistently giving that sort of feedback,
yeah.
And it became overwhelming for his players, and they were suffocating under that.
Yeah, and they couldn't stand it. And that's what's and what you said earlier is important to note, is that that is what the assistants are for, which is what makes it so ironic that Michel Therrien is now an assistant, which is so in light of the question that led this whole thing off. So
I'm curious to see how long that will last. I'm skeptical.
Yeah, me too. I think he's being paid pretty handsomely for an assistant, so that helps. But yeah, he doesn't seem to be wired that way. But I think it was a smart move for him to stay in the league at least.
Yeah.
Rather than insist on having a head coaching job, and maybe it'll work out for him. I never thought Jacques Martin would be an assistant again, and he is.
Yeah, well, that's his way of slowly, fading in the horizon.
He wanted that head job in Ottawa. Like, that was sincere. But anyhow,
I know. But he understands where he's at in his career.
Too. So all that to say that this is why you have assistant coaches. Everyone has their role. Head coaches are not always cuddly teddy bears. They rarely are. Claude Julien is not. So yeah, if you're doing things well, and if you're in the lineup, you will hear from your coach if your coach is Claude Julien. Sometimes if you're not in the lineup, you might not hear from him as often as you'd like. And you
might hear from Kirk Muller.
You might, but not even. In my experience over the last few years, just talking to guys who have been, like, talking to Mike Riley last year. Didn't get much direction from anyone, really. I mean, Luke talked to him sometimes, but, you know, I don't know if those guys are ever given sort of guidance on what path to take back into the lineup, sort of thing. So maybe that's sort of a blind spot for this coaching staff. But when you're in the lineup, there's a lot of one-on-one interaction, and there's a lot of feedback, and there's back and forth that I can see, at least.
We should do this again, Arpin. I think it's been our longest podcast of the season. So
we'll do it. Well, I'm going to be doing a mailbag column at the end of every month.
Yeah.
So maybe we could do a mailbag pod as a follow-up to that column every month.
That's good. All right, let's do that. That's a brilliant idea. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And you have a good weekend. Bye-bye.